Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Christmas Eve, 1945. A fire engulfs a home, a devastating tragedy. But the aftermath is where the mystery truly begins. Five children vanish. No remains, no clear answers, just a lingering sense of unease, and a whole lot of questions. We're exploring a case that's been shrouded in mystery for years, the mystery of the Sauter family. Welcome back to Macabre Mondays, where mystery meets the macabre, with your favorite Dudley duo. I'm Ale.
And I'm Tom.
Your guides through the strange, the sinister, and the spooky. Today, we're diving into the mysterious disappearance of the Sauter children. Tom, have you ever heard of the Sauter children before?
I haven't.
Ooh.
But I kind of like that this is something that's been happening since 1945.
Yep.
Gives me Zach Baggins.
Zach Baggins, please come on our show. All right, so to understand this story, let's start with the Sauter family's beginnings. George Sauter, born Giorgio Sodu, I think I say that's so wrong, in Sardinia, Italy, was just 13 years old. Thanks, Phoebe. That was one of our doggies. Was just 13 years old when he left his homeland to find a new life in America. Like so many immigrants of the time, he saw opportunity and he found it. Eventually, he settled in Fayetteville, West Virginia, a mining town nestled in the Appalachians. It was here he met Jenny Cipriani, a fellow Italian immigrant. Together, George and Jenny built a life filled with love and hard work. George ran a coal hauling business, which was both profitable and respected in the community. They went on to have 10 children.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
Were they Catholic?
So, no, they were not Catholic. There's nothing that I can research or find that had said if they were Catholic or not. But I don't know why. I'm assuming they are just because they were raised Italian immigrants and everything. So
they check off all the boxes.
They're the Italian, 10 children.
10 children, big family.
Yes, very hardworking for sure. So they had 10 children. I'm going to list off their names and their ages, so try to keep up, okay? 10.
All right, we'll be back in 45 seconds.
Sylvia, the youngest child, was born in 1942. Jenny was age 8. Betty, age 5. Martha, age 12. Louis, age 9. Maurice, age 14. George Jr., 16. John, 23. And Marion, 17. So there's a wide variety there.
Yeah.
They've been busy. So they raised them very tight-knit and in a supportive household. Their home became a symbol of hard work, determination, and the American dream. But George's outspoken political views made him some enemies. He was a staunch critic of Italy's fascist dictator, Benito Mussolini. In the tight-knit Italian community they lived in, this stance didn't go unnoticed. In fact, it led to heated arguments and even threats. As the holidays approached in 1945, the Sauter family looked forward to Christmas. The kids were full of excitement, eagerly anticipating the gifts and festivities. Their eldest daughter, Marion, had recently bought toys for her younger siblings with the money she earned from her job. The house was alive with anticipation. Now, I think Marion, from what I was reading, she worked at a dollar store or whatnot.
Okay.
But this is also 1945, so...
So, like, probably like a regular degular convenience
store. Yeah,
she's
still she's making her money. I mean, she bought some gifts for her younger siblings. I'm sure she must have felt really great doing that. But amidst this joy, strange events began to unfold. Just weeks before Christmas, a man visited the home to discuss life insurance with George.
Oh, Lord.
But this wasn't a normal sales pitch. This man looked George in the eye and ominously warned him, "Your house will go up in smoke and your children are going to be destroyed." All because he denied the life insurance. It was December 24, 1945. The Sauter family celebrated Christmas Eve together. And around 10 p.m., Jenny sent the younger children to bed, where they slept in the attic. She left some of the children up a bit later to enjoy their gifts. At about 12:30 a.m., so it's a little over midnight, the phone rings, waking Jenny. Jenny picked up the receiver, only to hear a woman's voice asking for a name that she did not recognize. In the background, she heard laughter, clinking glasses, and other party sounds. When Jenny told the woman she had the wrong number, she heard an eerie, unfamiliar laugh before the line went dead, so she went back to bed, but she felt a little bit unsettled with the call.
As one would.
Right. Jenny noticed that all the lights were still on. The doors were unlocked and the curtains were still open in her home. The kids usually closed up the house before heading to their beds in the attic. And that's kind of like the agreement she had with them. Like, hey, you can stay up. Just make sure, you know, remember to
lock up,
close, you know, close the house, closing time, close the house up. Shrugging it off, she closed everything up and went back to sleep thinking nothing of it. You know, maybe they just forgot. It's Christmas Eve. They're kids. You know, they're playing with their toys.
They're excited.
Exactly.
Energy.
But then Jenny woke again an hour later by a loud bang on the roof and a rolling sound. She had said it sort of sounded like a rubber ball rolling and hitting the ground with a thump. Now imagine lying in bed, half asleep, hearing a noise like that, right? So Jenny stayed still, kind of holding her breath, hoping it was nothing, and she managed to be able to go back to sleep. About 30 minutes later, Jenny awoke again, this time to the unmistakable smell of smoke. Rushing downstairs, she discovered the fire spreading rapidly from George's office. She screamed, waking George and the rest of the family who were sleeping upstairs. Jenny and George managed to escape with four of their 10 children, Sylvia, Marion, John, and George Jr., but five were still trapped inside.
Oh my gosh.
In the attic. George immediately sprang into action, his mind racing with plans to reach them. They couldn't go up in the attic because flames had already started up the stairs. They yelled up to the kids to see if they could get their attention and didn't hear anything back from them. But with every attempt George tried to make, he came by unexplainable failures. He kept a ladder by his house for maintenance use around his home. It was nowhere to be found. And so he thought, let me use one of my work vehicles, because he's in the coal business, to bring it to the side of the home and climb up to the upper window so he could rescue them, the rest of the children. But neither of his trucks would start, though they'd worked just fine hours earlier. George even tried scooping water from a rain barrel to put out the fire, but it was frozen solid. As the flames consumed their home, George and Jenny stood outside helpless. They could only watch as the fire destroyed everything that they had built, with their five children presumably trapped inside. So who was still inside was Maurice, which was 14, Martha, 12, Louie, 9, Jenny, that was 8, and Betty, age 5. They never made it out of the house. Marion tried to call the fire department but couldn't. The phone lines were down. They headed to a neighbor's house to try calling the fire department there, and sadly, the operator was unavailable.
What?
Yep. A man that was actually driving by was the one that called the fire department using a phone in town. So there was really nothing that they could do but just wait and hope. Their house took a total of 45 minutes to fully burn down.
So I was gonna say, I don't know if you have photos of the house, but back in this day, this is a quick little snippet from former firefighter Tom. So back in the day, houses, think of the McAllister house from Home Alone.
Okay.
That's called a balloon frame building.
Okay.
So back in the day, homes were built that way. And typically, if you had a window on the first floor, window was on the second floor. What that meant was the structure was open in between the walls from the first floor all the way through the second.
Okay.
And the third, or however tall the building was.
Yeah.
So if you had a fire break out, the minute it got into the walls, it immediately spiked and climbs super quick.
I did not know that.
So that is just a little snippet.
That's good to know. It's kind of like when you know when you buy a home or you see some videos on like TikTok or whatnot, and they're like, what's this weird crawl space here? It's like nothing really. It's just how the home was built.
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. That's good to know.
So
thank
obviously
you.
Don't know if you have photos of the home, but if the windows are straight up and down from each other and it looks similar to how the McAllister's house looks, it's probably a balloon frame, and that's also probably why the flames crawled and climbed so quickly.
Right. Let me see. I have a home here that looks similar. It's two stories, and it did have the windows you're talking about, like, stacked on top of each other and stuff. Yeah, that's pretty much how their home was.
So then, so you can only imagine
how fast that went up in flames. Yeah, because 45 minutes to me sounds really fast.
Yeah.
But then again, I'm assuming, like, you know, the materials they were using back then to build these homes, and like you're saying, the structures and the floor plans that they had. It's just so sad. So this might even upset you, firefighter Tom. But the morning after the fire, so it took the fire department actually 7 hours to get to them.
Hold up, what?
Yes, they were only 2.5 miles away, the fire department. They pretty much arrived around like 8 a.m. So yeah, it took them literally 7 hours to reach the Sauter family. And I started looking up, right? Because I'm like, why would it take them 7 hours to reach a home that's only 2.5 miles away from them? And a lot of things I was finding is that the fire department could have been delayed in responding to them, to their call, due to a number of factors. And some of them are staffing shortage. It could have been difficulty contacting the firefighters, you know, to kind of wake them. I don't know how the situation was back then. The frozen water barrels. As I mentioned earlier, George tried to fight the fire with a bucket of water, but that water was frozen. So I'm assuming the firefighters too would probably have an issue with that. Chief's inexperience was one, because there was a rumor that the fire chief didn't know how to drive the fire truck and had to wait for someone else to do it.
I'm sorry.
That could be.
You're telling me.
It could be an explanation.
The chief of the department didn't know how to drive a fire truck.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the claims it could be. And then the other one is the phone operator. The phone operator may not have responded to the call from a neighbor who summoned the fire department. So it could have been a mix of a bunch of stuff, you know. But obviously they didn't arrive until daylight. 7 hours later, I have to reemphasize that. They searched for 2 hours through the debris to try to find the children under all that. But they were unsuccessful.
Wait, hold on. So, like, you're telling me no corpses?
Oh, just you wait. They conducted a brief investigation. The conclusion was reached that faulty wiring had sparked the blaze. But this explanation didn't sit right with George and Jenny. They were convinced something far more sinister was at play. There were no human remains that were found in the ashes. The local fire chief suggested that the fire was hot enough to completely incinerate all traces of the children. But George and Jenny wanted to fight for the truth, and that led them to contact local officials, newspapers, and even the FBI. In fact, George wrote to J. Edgar Hoover himself, requesting federal involvement. Hoover expressed a willingness to help, but the local authorities blocked any external investigation. Frustrated, the Sauters took matters into their own hands. They hired a private investigators and conducted their own research. They placed ads in newspapers, printed handbills, and distributed photographs of the children across the country, leaving no stone unturned. But experts soon weighed in, stating that even the most intense fires, bones still remain. So where were the children? Adding to the mystery, it was discovered by a telephone technician that the house's phone line had actually been deliberately cut.
I knew it. I had a feeling.
You're like, Marion was making a call. I know it wasn't. I know. Yes. Rather than damaged by the fire, makes sense to why, you know, she couldn't make that call. And missing the ladder, remember that we said that when he went to go find the ladder that he
kind of find it, yeah.
The one that we mentioned earlier, they found it in a ditch 75 feet away from the house, as if someone had purposely thrown it there.
So let me guess. Next thing that they find out, oh, his work trucks don't have a starter in them. Somebody took them or they were destroyed.
Well, now that you ask about George's truck, a witness later came forward claiming that he saw a man at the scene of the fire taking a block and tackle, which was a tool used for removing car engines. Could this be why George's truck refused to start that night? The man actually admitted to stealing the equipment, but denied having anything to do with the fire.
Oh,
I know.
Inside job.
And it's just crazy because I read somewhere too that Marion even stated that during the fire, she never saw any one of the children at the window. Like, you know, if something like that were to happen, you'd expect that they would be at the window, you know, like screaming for help or any. It's just odd, right? It's very odd.
Now that you mention that, now it comes across. Now it almost makes me wonder if they're not finding anything, were the kids kidnapped?
Right.
Or did like somebody come in, tie them up?
Well, and also, just I want to reference back to the firefighters thing, because I just did a quick little snippet, and another reason why it probably took them a while to get there was the fact that a lot of the firefighters at that time were volunteers and they didn't have that much training. So imagine they're probably like, Well, I don't know. What about you?
Firefighter Tom here with another
fun here we
fact.
Go. Go for it.
So, in 1736, okay. For those of you that don't know, Benjamin Franklin was actually considered the founding father of the fire department. However, he established the first volunteer fire company in Philadelphia. At that time, basically all fire departments were volunteer.
Right.
Now, any paid fire department all the way through the mid-1800s, so we're talking probably 1850, 1860s, mm-hmm. those were all only paid by private insurance companies. So back in the day, if you paid into this insurance company, you would get, typically it was like a little red placard, it'd go on your house. In the middle of the night, if you had a fire, something's happening,
right.
and the fire
they
department
would obviously
shows
prioritize
up,
yours.
And they see, no, this is for only paid. So if they saw, they would take care of your house. Now,
shocked.
All the way through the mid-19th century, that's when paid fire departments actually started being a thing.
Wow.
So literally, we're talking only maybe 70 years ago. So literally around this time,
yeah.
we started seeing more and more paid fire departments become a thing.
Right. So now they help everyone, not just...
Exactly.
Or it's not just volunteers and such and all
exactly.
that. Wow.
And the first one actually didn't even launch until like in the 1850s, same time around this time. And it was actually in Cincinnati, Ohio. And it was considered one of the biggest turning points in the fire protection industry because, as I mentioned, typically fire protection was only tied to private insurance companies and their associated brigades.
Wow, that's so interesting. Fun facts with Tom. That's something about Tom, guys, that you will come to learn, is that he's always got this wealth of knowledge of a lot of different topics, so you can always have a conversation with him about anything and everything. That's great to know. Thank you, Firefighter Tom.
When we first met, Alejandra didn't believe me that I had lived all these past lives.
Oh my God, yeah. We'll talk about that in another episode. Like I was saying, Marion even stated about watching the windows and she didn't see anybody come to the window. So she thought that was really weird. But all these odd things to say, right? Over the following weeks, tips began to flood in. One woman actually claimed to have seen the Sodder children peering from a car as it sped away from the house the night of the fire.
I knew it.
Okay, well, it's a tip and we don't know. And then someone claimed. Another woman said she saw four of them at a Charleston hotel the morning after the fire, accompanied by two mysterious adults. Now, the Sodders' search for answers led them down a rabbit hole of dead ends and strange leads. Yet, as years went on, bizarre encounters and cryptic messages only fueled their suspicion that something much darker lay beneath the surface. Tips and leads flowed in continuously, each one leading them further from any concrete answer. A woman had claimed to have spotted children in Charleston Hotel, and another reported seeing them boarding a train in the early morning hours after the fire. Yet, every time the Sodders try to follow these leads, they reach dead ends, with witnesses reluctant or even afraid to speak further. Some speculated that George's outspoken stance against Mussolini and the fascist party may have made him enemies powerful enough to target his family. Some believed the mafia had taken the children to coerce George into silence. Others speculated that the children had been sold on the black market. And yet, even after hiring private investigators, the Sodders were no closer to the truth. Perhaps the most chilling evidence actually came in 1968 when Jenny received a letter postmarked from Kentucky. Inside was a photograph of a young man with features strikingly similar to her missing son, Louis. Written on the back were the cryptic words, "Louis Sodder, I love brother Frankie. A little boys," but the family was unable to trace the sender or confirm the boy's identity, though they hired a private investigator to track down the origin of the letter, and the trail went cold. The man they hired vanished without a trace, leaving Jenny and George with even more questions.
I mean, same.
Left and right, there's like, you don't know what the hell's going on. So the pain of that December night would linger with George and Jenny for the rest of their lives. They never gave up their search for answers, clinging to every lead, no matter how small or unlikely. In their backyard, George created a garden on the site where their home once stood, a poignant memorial to the children he refused to believe were truly gone. And through the years, George drove across the country following tips, holding out hope that one day he would find his missing children. George sadly passed away in 1968, never knowing what happened to them. Jenny, too, held on to hope, wearing all black in mourning for the rest of her life until her passing in the 1980s. She kept a billboard near their home with photos of the missing children and a reward of $5,000 for any information that could lead to them. This billboard became an enduring symbol of their desperate search, a plea to the world that they would never forget, never stop questioning. Even today, the mystery remains unsolved. What truly happened to the Sauter family? Did George's anti-fascist beliefs make his family a target? Were they kidnapped? Or was this all a tragic accident, amplified by inconclusive evidence?
That is wild.
Yes.
But I feel like out of all the theories, kidnapping to me, if you think about everything from this case, mm-hmm. their mom literally said, oh, prior to them going up to the attic to go to bed, they always closed up the house. She gets a random call. Nothing happens. Nothing occurs. I know, but still. But
putting it all together, I see
they've
what you're
done it for so many times. Then on top of it, all of a sudden, fire breaks out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she hears that noise on the roof.
Yep.
I mean, she wakes up like three times this night.
Nothing is found of those kids. His truck is damaged, even though the guy just claims whatever.
Right, he's like, yeah, I stole it, but I had nothing to do with the fire.
I was just being a thief. It just so happened to be the same
the
night.
The fact that Marion claims that she didn't see anybody come mm-hmm. to the window. But then again, let's say you're sleeping, right?
Yeah.
And there is a fire going on. Is there any, now I have to look it up, but is there any way that the smell, what is it, the carbon monoxide of the smoke, like put you to, you guys are gonna hear a lot of that.
So you have monoxide and dioxide.
Well, that's what I mean, like if you're sleeping, never mind, that has nothing to do with this case.
That's like a gas leak.
Gotcha. Okay, so then never mind, because that to me, I'm like, maybe that, but never mind, that honestly just cuts my theory.
Well, your theory kind of has some, because remember what I mentioned about blue and frame buildings?
Yeah,
basically once the fire breaks in, as I mentioned earlier, that wall now acts like a chimney and the fire can just climb. So if the kids are in the attic and they're trying to get to the windows, you gotta think your windows are on that exterior wall where all the fire is climbing.
Oh, so, look at that. I didn't think about that. Right. Might have been too hot or something.
Yes. Yeah. But
that's
still,
how they say to touch the, if you have the door closed, to touch the door handle to mm-hmm. see, to feel the,
with the back of your hand, folks. Back of your hand.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, my theory too is like, when I think about it, okay, let's say they were kidnapped, right? Why? Just because George, I mean, I get it. Let's say it's like mafia or whatever the case is.
I mean, the mafia in the 60s.
Well, it was the 40s, but yeah.
Or 40s, sorry.
But my thing is, kidnap them and then do what? Raise them? Maybe sell them? I could see the black market. I mean, there was no more traces to be found.
I was going to say, that's the thing. Usually the mafia, from what we've all seen, if the mafia did something and it was retaliation or to send a message, they made sure you knew.
That's what I mean.
Like, there was no secret. It was a, hey, we just want you to know we have this power.
Then that's why to me I'm like, maybe the black market. I mean, the fact that there were no bones, no type of remains found when I did my research, that they didn't even find clothes.
Clothes, that's one thing.
But bones.
Bones, I looked up because I was kind of curious. Bones disintegrate between 1400 to 1800 degrees. That's when a bone becomes ash. However, your typical house fire is typically between 1000 to 2000 degrees. 2000 at like the max. So if they're laying in their bed, they're not near the ceiling. The ceiling is typically where the hottest point is, and that's usually around 1500 degrees.
And but that's what I mean. Even with five kids, there should have at least been something. But then I mean, you have a point there. I totally get it. And I also feel though too, I mean, maybe they did disintegrate. Maybe that's just how it was. And
it's possible.
If you think about it, at that time, they probably, not the technology, but the knowledge to have for forensics and things like that weren't as advanced.
Yeah.
So that definitely also had to have a play in that too. I just think, I mean, yeah, I have a feeling that they might have, I mean, they could have been kidnapped, but again, maybe the only other conclusion that I think to it, if they weren't incinerated, was the fact that they were sold off on the black market.
Yeah. It also just, it gives like another weird thing though. Why would some random person from Kentucky
send this letter?
Yeah.
Well, maybe they're messing with them. I don't know. If you're thinking about, I mean, people, I know.
But how many years later was that?
years, but they've been, but Jenny and George have been looking and searching for, and they even got Jay Hoover on that.
But
come on, there's people agree. You see what I'm saying?
But how many people years later randomly are just like, you know what would be fun?
There are cold hearted. You're going to, you know, this is why I love bringing Tom, why I wanted to bring Tom on these, because every time there was something going on in the world or I have a story or I tell him my thought process, he's like, okay, well, that might be too much. And I'm like, oh, because of all the stories I've heard, you'd be very surprised. So I'm ready to get Tom on this train with us all at once. It happens. Okay, babe. I don't care what you say. Thank you for joining us today on Macabre Mondays. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts.
We'd love to hear from you. If you have a story that's strange, sinister, or downright spooky, send it our way. You can email us at macabremondayspodcast@gmail.com or head over to macabremondays.com to submit your story. Yours might just be featured in an upcoming listener episode.
Follow us on social media by searching Macabre Mondays for photos of today's episode, updates, and a little extra spooky fun. Stay tuned. More mystery is just around the corner. We'll see you next Monday for another sinister, strange, or spooky episode. And until then, stay curious and stay safe. Bye, everyone. Today's episode was researched with the help of resources including the Fayette Tribune and the Charleston Gazette Mail for details on the fire and early investigations, Smithsonian Magazine for deeper insights into the Sauter family's search for answers, and True Crime Files for theories and public speculation surrounding the case. Additional context was drawn from The Mystery of the Sauter Children Disappearance, a documentary covering key details and later developments, and The Unresolved podcast, which explores the unsolved aspects and societal impact of the Sauter's family's relentless pursuit of justice.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love, with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.